How's it going, everybody? This is Eric from Spawnkill, and just a little intro of what you're going to be listening to here. This is the Disney Epic Mickey developer call with Warren Spector, general manager and creative director of Disney Interactive Studios Junction Point. So you're going to be listening to a lot of him talking, and every now and then you'll hear the moderator, Chase, jumping in to throw some questions his way. It was a pretty interesting call. You're going to get a little more insight to how the game was developed from the beginning stages, and you also learn a lot about the history of Disney cartoons as well. Definitely can tell that Warren Spector is very, very passionate about this this title and about you know, cartoons and the artists behind them. So normally the interview will get to a point where it'll open up to the media, but kind of never got to that point. So if you have any questions that the developer called didn't answer, you know, feel free to leave them in the comments, and we'll see if we can get them answered for you. All right, enjoy.
Are you on the line, Warren?
You want to just jump right in?
Oh, yeah, excellent. If you can provide everybody with a quick overview about the game, and then we're going to start firing off these questions because we got a lot of them, and a lot of good stuff here today.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to be as brief as I can. You know how tough that'll be for me if any of you ever talked to me before, but we are here to talk about Disney Epic Mickey. We're rapidly approaching the release date. Been waiting a while for this moment, but we're releasing in North America on November 30th. Exclusively on the Wii. And, you know, I suspect that most of you already know something about the game, but just in case you don't, it's, you know, Mickey's first appearance in a video game in a while. He is the hero of our story and the player's avatar. And in this game, Mickey finds himself trapped in a world called Wasteland, a world basically of, for 80 years of forgotten and creativity. In that world, he uses a new ability. We're reminding him he's a cartoon character, and cartoon characters are made of paint and ink. So we allow him and allow the player to dynamically change the world by drawing and erasing. You can remove pretty much anything painted from the game, characters, objects, walls, floors, you name it, and then bring them back, restore them using the power of paint. So that's kind of the core of the gameplay, and I guess you have a lot of questions, so maybe I'll be quiet and we'll just get right to them.
All right, so here's a quick and easy question for you. Where did the idea for Disney Epic Mickey come from?
You know, it's an interesting story. The idea actually originated at Disney. I was, you know, an independent developer. I had created Junction Point as an independent, and I was out pitching publishers on a bunch of game ideas, a science fiction game and a fantasy game, and one of the publishers I pitched was Disney. They weren't interested in what I was pitching, but they asked if I was interested in hearing their pitch for a Mickey game, and of course I was, you know, as a Disney fan, and, you know, as a guy who I was sitting there thinking, my God, they're offering me, you know, the opportunity to work with a character as popular and successful and recognizable as Mickey Mouse. Yeah, I want to hear that. And they had three or four core ideas that are still in the game today. The idea of Wasteland started with Disney. The idea of bringing Oswald the Lucky Rabbit back started with Disney. Even the idea of Mickey being kidnapped by the Phantom Blot started at Disney. So some of those foundation elements were there right at the beginning. And they said, you know, you don't have to use any of these ideas. And I just said, man, there's no way I'm not. They're genius. And no one's going to make that game but me and my team. So that was kind of how it started.
So in this question, actually, they throw up a lot of different areas, but let's just grab one of them. It says, what was the hardest part for you and the team while working on this game? Is it the story, the gameplay, the controller?
You know, honestly, the hardest part was just the massive amounts of information we had. You know, Disney threw open the floodgates, basically. We had full access to all of the Disney archives. We chose to limit ourselves to, you know, things that have been forgotten and rejected, but really Disney was incredibly open. And, you know, even though my teams often describe me as the kitchen sink designer, I throw everything in, you know. This time there was just so much source material Probably deciding what not to include was the toughest part.
So you've been responsible for some, quote, edgy games over the past 20 years. How much of this edge is finding its way into Disney Epic Mickey, and can you give an example?
Well, I think a fair amount of it, actually. I don't ever think about things in terms of, you know, let's be dark and edgy. I just sort of tell stories I like telling, and, you know, creating worlds I like that I think are interesting. So I don't really think about it in those terms, but certainly, you know, this is a kind of a darker world, I guess, than people might expect. You know, and I think that's reflected in kind of the when you start out, like you see familiar places, like a version of It's a Small World or a version of Main Street USA, but really kind of run down and with the color drained out of it and parts of it kind of wrecked and twisted a little bit. And I think that could shock a lot of Disney fans, maybe, in a good way, I hope. But I think there's a little bit of edge there in the ways we're treating some of Disney's properties, and I mean literal properties, like the places you visit when you go to the theme parks.
So how different is it moving from a sci-fi themed games to Disney Mickey Mouse and the Gang?
You know, I guess you could say it would be hard, except I have a pretty strong background in this sort of content. Though people in the electronic game space and computer games and video games, I think, you know, they've only seen the side of me that does, you know, epic fantasy and, you know, dark science fiction stuff. If you go back to my tabletop game days when I was working at Steve Jackson Games and TSR, you know, I mean, I worked on Toon the Cartoon role-playing game, and I worked on the Bullwinkle and Rocky party role-playing game. I wrote my master's thesis on cartoons. I mean, I used to be the funny guy. I know it's hard to believe now, but I used to be the funny guy. So I guess, you know, a lot of people who didn't have that background might have had trouble, but for me it was kind of like just getting back to stuff I know really, really well and enjoy immensely.
So in Disney Epic Mickey, there's obviously a lot of different locations based on Disney properties. What Disney universe within Disney Epic Mickey are you most proud of?
Well, I guess I have to ask a question before I answer it. Is any of this embargoed, or does it go live today?
It goes live today.
Then I can't talk about the place that I want to talk about. Yeah, there. I will say that there is one place that I'm really, really proud of, and really kind of amazed that we actually managed to get into the game, because it is. I guess if you want to look for edge, I guess that's where you'd find it.
Well, given what we've already shared about the various locations, it just gives them one more thing to be excited about.
I guess. I hate to be evasive there, but that's there's one thing that I just don't want to talk about quite yet. The one thing, I will say one other thing, and probably be equally cryptic and annoying, I'm really, really proud of the end game. I think the way this game wraps up is really cool and surprisingly emotional. I think people are going to be surprised at how much emotion you can wring out of a video game when they see that. So I'm really, really proud of that. I know that doesn't answer the question, but I wanted to get that out there.
Cool. So a good portion of the art design is based on Disney art in the late 20s to 70s. Why was this era chosen over the more modern Disney art styles?
Well, that's pretty simple, actually. One of those foundation elements that I got right from Disney was the idea of a world of forgotten and rejected Disney stuff. And I liked that so much because, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously Disney is still a vital, central part of American and world culture. I don't think people appreciate just how much Disney contributed, the corporation and the man, frankly, contributed to the 20th century and the 21st century in terms of entertainment. And so I really liked the idea of limiting this game to material that Disney himself touched. And that limited us to 1928 to 1967, because the last things Disney, the man, worked on were the Pirates of the Caribbean ride and Jungle Book, which both appeared in 1967. Now, I will say this. I've already had I didn't want to actually mention this, but I'm gonna say one thing here. We violated that rule. we violated that rule in a couple of places, and I'll let you guys figure out where they are. But for the most part, we limited ourselves to things before 1967. For the reason I already said, but also because I've gotten to meet some of the animators and artists who worked on more recent things, and I just don't want to be the guy who says, "Wow, that work you did 5 years ago, that was really not very good." You know, I'm not going to be that guy.
So the initial illustrations released during the project's early life differ quite dramatically from what we see in the final version today. Can you talk for a moment about how the game's art style and direction has evolved over the course of development?
That's a huge question, obviously. There was some concept art that was leaked, and that was a genuine leak. We did not do that on purpose, that's for sure. Stuff just got out there inadvertently, and what that was a small sample of one of the art styles that we were considering. When in any game, what I like to do anyway is I do two things. I like to get a variety of options in front of me, so I always have the artist put, you know, half a dozen versions of this character in front of me. Oh, no, wait, let's have another dozen, which annoys people, I'm sure, but I want a lot of options, and I think projects benefit from having a lot of options. And also, I always tell my teams, not just about artwork, but about everything, anytime you think you've gone far enough with whatever you're working on, go 20% further, and I'll pull you back if you've gone too far. Because the only way to find out where a line is to cross it. And so some of the artwork that got out there was me very consciously saying, okay, we've got to work with our partners at Disney to determine, you know, what's the creative box within which this game is going to exist. All games exist within a box. You know, I couldn't put Magic in Deus Ex. You wouldn't put a 747 in Red Dead Redemption, I don't think. You know, everything happens within creative constraints. And in this case, I wanted to collaborate with folks at Disney to determine where the lines were that you don't cross. And so some of the artwork that got out was me consciously thinking, you know, or at least assuming I was going too far. Some of it was me just wanting options. And some of it was, like I said, where we were at that time. What I hope people do is, instead of judging what might have been, judge what is. You know, the bottom line is, I've been lucky enough in my career that I've never had to ship a game. Well, that's not true. I've had a couple where I've had to ship a little too soon, but I've always been happy with what we were doing. And in this case, I think my personal opinion is that the team did an amazing job. I mean, the art team just knocked it out of the park as far as I'm concerned, and I love the way the game looks. So I hope people will judge what's on the screen. And not, you know, a leaked piece of concept art from 3 years ago.
So this next question sort of deals with a popular misconception about Mickey. What inspired you to take a darker approach to a Mickey video game?
Well, there are a bunch of ways to interpret that question, so I'm going to interpret it the way I want. The reality is, Mickey himself isn't darker. The world he is in is darker than people might expect. That is absolutely true. And the reasons for that are a couple of them. One is, I kind of referred to this earlier, and it was implied in an earlier question. I kind of like darker stuff, you know, just personally. Also, one of the big goals for the project was to sort of establish Mickey as a video game hero on the same level as a Mario or a Link or a Master Chief even. And if you're gonna be a hero, you have to have something serious. You have to have a serious problem to push up against, to solve. And so the world needed to be a pretty dark place because Mickey, and I don't mind saying this, every player is going to bring light to this world. And if you're going to have light, you have to have dark, you know? There's parts of the game that I personally think are really sad. And, you know, if you're going to bring happiness, if Mickey is going to bring happiness to this world, there has to be sadness to start with. So there are a lot of reasons why the world would be dark and why the world of Wasteland is dark, and I think they're all justified by the story and supported by the gameplay.
So speaking of the gameplay, did the main gameplay concept of Disney Epic Mickey always involve the paintbrush as Mickey's primary tool and the mechanics of paint and thinner, or were there times over the development process that the team perhaps tinkered with other concepts for Mickey to partake in, or was there, was the paint theme always the main gameplay mechanic throughout development?
Well, you know, we started with some foundation elements from Disney, but basically we had a blank screen, you know, an empty Word document, you know, so I can't say it was there from the beginning. It wasn't one of those foundation elements that came from Disney, you know, at the start. But it came fairly early on. You know, one of the early discussions that I had with, I had two collaborators when we started this. I was working with a designer-writer named Alan Varney and a programmer named Alex Duran. And the three of us, obviously we had consultations with the rest of the Junction Point team, but the three of us really did the heavy lifting on the initial concept. And fairly early on, we said, you know, it'd be cool to remind Mickey and remind players and remind Disney fans that Mickey is a cartoon character, not real. You know, he's not a real mouse. He's not a real thing. He's a cartoon character. And so we started thinking about what that means. And to make a long story short, you know, we fairly quickly hit on, hey, we should give him control over the stuff he's made of. It was actually another programmer on the team, a guy named Matt Baer, who came up with that initial idea. And, you know, I started thinking, well, you know, yeah, that's a great idea. Holy cow, let him use paint, to the stuff he's made up, to create things. But I'm the guy who makes games about choices and consequences, and so we have to offer the player the opportunity to do the opposite of that. What is the opposite of that? It's erasing things. So, you know, I just sort of condensed 6 months into a minute, but... you know, it was a fairly early thing that has undergone pretty steady development and refinement over the last 3 years.
So Disney Epic Mickey seemed to have skipped many generations of consoles. Now we finally get a Mickey game similar to the magic of SNES and Genesis days. Why did it take so long for a game like Disney Epic Mickey to be made, and what made this the right time?
You know, I'm probably not the right person to answer that. I can say... I can say a little bit about that, in that, you know, from the outside, I remember reading interviews with Graham Hopper, who runs Disney Interactive Studios, before I signed on, before I knew anything about the project, where he was saying, you know, we're gonna sort of rest Mickey. I mean, Disney does that with all of their properties. You know, they'll release something and then take it away for, you know, 7 years or 10 years or whatever it is. And I know he made comments about how, you know, there was a decision made, like I said, I was not involved in this, to sort of give Mickey a rest in the video game space. And I guess they just thought I was the right guy with the right idea, you know, the right game to bring him back. That's a little outside my area of expertise.
So what is it about this game that will make it stand out graphically from first-party Wii titles? Also, did you run into any limitations that you would like to have seen happen but couldn't?
Okay, there are two questions there. What I think makes it stand out is, the darkness, I guess. The dark cartooniness of it. You know, I think not just on the Nintendo, on most platforms, you see games that are bright and cheerful and primary colors and happy and all that stuff, and traditionally cartoony. And then you see games that are, you know, monochromatic. I mean, I say, you know, we're in a period of, well, is this year the year all games are gray, or is this the year that all games are blue or brown? Which is it this year? And I challenged the team from day one, basically, the art team in particular, to make a game that, you know, in the 5 seconds you have as a person runs from one booth to another at E3, I wanted players to in that five-second period where we can grab their attention, to look at a screen and know that it was our game, and know that it was not like any other game. So there was that challenge, and I think they met that. And I also said I want a game that looks like, you know, a Disney animated feature. There's a lushness that Disney feature animated films have. Especially we use Pinocchio a lot as an example. I think that's kind of the pinnacle of sort of traditional Disney animation in terms of art direction. And you know, so we used those lush, rich, colorful movies as inspiration. And we also did some stuff that I never knew about this before. I visited Pixar, you know, as we were working on this, and they have these color scripts posted, which they're not storyboards, but they sort of provide an overview of the colors that dominate the scenes in different locations as the movie progresses. And I was really taken by that. So we did a lot of color scripting, where we just say, you know, here's what each world is going to look like from a palette standpoint. Not even with representational images, just what colors, dominate this game. I've never talked about this, actually. I really should be talking about this more. But what colors dominate which parts of the game and which parts of the world? So you put all that together, you know, we've got 5 seconds to show people we're different, the lush, rich color of Disney feature films, and then the color scripting technique, and the darkness of it. I think you put that all together, and we have something unique from a visual standpoint.
Cool. So you mentioned Pixar, and I think that could tie in from what I've heard you field this question in the past, but what sort of audience did the team have when trying to make this title?
Well, yeah, actually, Pixar was a really important part of that. You know, when I started thinking about this game and talking to people at Feature Animation, like I said, I knew, you know, this is not like making a Deus Ex, where, you know, my team created the characters and the team created the world, and we can do whatever we want. I mean, Mickey is a character who is known to almost everyone on the planet, and so, you know, we had to kind of work with our partners at Disney and even talk to you know, Disney fans about what is the right way to approach this game. And in talking to folks at Pixar, I mean, John Lasseter, actually, in particular, he said something in my first meeting with him that just, I mean, oh my God, it just like, it rang like a bell, you know? And he just said, at Pixar, we don't make movies for a target audience. We make entertainment for everyone. And I heard that message at Disney Feature Animation. I heard it at Pixar, and I said, well, why can't a game aspire to the same goal? I'm not saying we achieved it, to be clear. That's for all the folks listening here and all the gamers who are going to play this and all the Disney fans who are going to play it, to say whether we succeeded. But I will say that it is our goal to make a game that was our goal, to make a game that kids and adults, boys, girls, men, women, could all appreciate. So we really didn't have a target audience in mind.
Okay, so, and obviously respecting any embargoes related to this next question, given that you were allowed access to the Disney Vault to make this game, what was one of the more obscure items that you had to put into your game? I mean, we have seen the Tiki Room and the Swiss Family Robinson Treehouse pre-Tarzan, but did you have something more obscure than that for detail-oriented fans of Disney?
Well, in terms of location, I don't know that it's even interesting, you know, to talk about that. I, players can play it and they'll decide what's obscure and what's not. But in terms of characters, you know, clearly Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, I mean, is the most obscure thing. I mean, no one remembers Oswald. Or, you know, if they do, they remember the Universal version from that came after the Disney period. So I think Oswald is probably the most obscure thing in the game, which is kind of appropriate, and I hope we change that. And after that, it's the Gremlins. I mean, I love those little guys, and you know, they're created for a movie that was in development in 1942 and 1943 and was never made. And you know, finding those guys and that was really special. And so the Oswald and the Gremlins, I think, are probably the most obscure things, and the things I'm really happiest about being able to bring back to audiences.
So, do any of the action maps use architecture or texture maps from the action locations on which they are based?
Well, not in the photographic sense, no. But you know, we did a lot of research. I mean, we obviously went to the archives, and you know, at Imagineering we got color tests. You know, like they did paintings to determine the actual literal, you know, like what is the Pantone color we're going to use here? Not literally Pantone, sorry, but you know, what color is on that building? And we used that information. But we also got to visit the parks. I sent some artists out to visit the park in Anaheim before it opened to the public, you know. And so we were able to walk around, and we have thousands of photographs of, you know, extreme close-ups of wall textures and floor textures and decals on weight barrels, you know, weight bins and things. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that the texture artists and environment artists used to create the world, but it was never our intention to do something that was photoreal. So it's not like we took a photograph and mapped it onto geometry. We never went that far, but there's a lot of stuff that's like, I mean, very super detailed that even, frankly, even fans aren't going to notice, where we used a photo of a texture or, you know, an image that an Imagineer painted in 1958 as a guide to color choice and texture usage. Yeah.
Okay, this next question could have a very broad, lengthy response, so you can truncate as you see fit. But, quote, many of us still define video games by their value as a means for fun and escape, judged in part by their level of rapid creativity. Disney Epic Mickey's design seems to parallel this approach. Can you tell us a bit about how you balance creativity and gameplay to produce such an enchanting game universe?
Yow. Well, first, thank you for describing it as enchanting game universe, whoever wrote that question. I hope that's the way people feel about it. You know, that is a huge question, and I'm tempted to give a really kind of a flip answer in that, you know, well, that's the magic, right? I mean, I've been making games for a long time, and I guess, you know, I get to make the next game because I'm pretty good at figuring that stuff out, and, you know, and I've got people on my team who are way smarter and way more talented than I am, who are really good at figuring out how to create that magic. There's kind of a question that wasn't asked there that I think I actually do want to answer, in that, you know, the game is in part an homage to Disney's creative history, but also to the creative process. You know, there's the fact that Mickey has a brush and players get to use, you know, not a weapon, but an art tool to solve problems really appeals to me, and it's kind of an homage to just the creativity of the artists at Disney. And there's a reason why our story moments are told in the form of storyboard art or concept art brought to life instead of, you know, what might be considered more traditional, final, hear the air quotes, you know, CGI graphics. The art style in our 2D storytelling moments, what you're seeing was actually inspired by animatics that we were going to use as guides for final CGI art, real rendered 3D art. And when I saw the animatics, I fell in love with them, and I said, no, wait, we should just put that on the screen and honor all of the Disney concept artists and storyboard artists whose work actually never gets out in front of the public. And so some of the magic, at least I hope, is honoring that the creative process and having gameplay that kind of gives players a little bit of an inkling into how that process might work.
So we've got a couple here questions about working with Disney, and you've touched upon some of these already. I mean, you've mentioned that you know, Disney lets you work with, you know, open the vaults, but I guess maybe we can talk about degrees. How open were Disney to letting Junction Point go in and use all of this historic art and characters for the game?
Absolutely, completely, totally, utterly, without limitation, open. I was amazed. You know, there were a couple of things where, you know, I remember having conversations not with the, you know, Disney proper, but with Disney Interactive Studios, which is the division Junction Point is a part of, and kind of saying, hey, you know, I want to do an Alice in Wonderland inspired world, but you know, Tim Burton's coming out with a movie. Maybe we should cut that. And everybody going, yeah, that's probably a good idea. We probably shouldn't do that. But it wasn't like I was ever told you can't use Alice in Wonderland, you know. And you know, there was a point. The closest anybody came to saying no was in the archives. I came across all of these amazing early rejected concepts for Tinkerbell, and I loved them. Some of them were really punk. And some of them were actually a little sexy. It was crazy. I mean, it was really cool stuff. And I was thinking about using those, and I don't remember who it was, but someone said, you know, there's a big fairies thing going on at Disney right now. And by the way, if you haven't watched the Tinkerbell movies that are coming out on DVD, they're actually really good. And so, you know, just there was sort of this opportunity or this possibility of confusion. You know, what's up with – are these – fairies different from the fairies in the Tinkerbell movies and everything. So, you know, there was a sort of a mutual decision not to go there, but there was nothing. I mean, no, at no point was I told, or was anybody on the team told, you can't look at that or use that or recreate that.
I remember you and you briefly mentioned something also about the amount of archival material they have.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. The first time, I mean, look, you have to understand, most Hollywood studios never even thought about the value in their you know, contracts and concept art and matte paintings and all that stuff. I mean, most of the studios junked all that stuff, and Disney kept it all. It's just astonishing. And so, well, I'll give you a specific example. When I the first time I went into the Imagineering archives with one of my writers and one of my tech artists, the first thing the guy who was sort of walking us through the archival holdings said was, "I'm sorry, we've only scanned 90,000 images so far." You know, okay. 90,000 images? Are you kidding me? I mean, just as amazing as it is, and as much as we got to look at and use, I was in the archives last week, the main archives on the studio lot, and one of the archivists there started pulling out Oswald material that I didn't know they had. You know, it's just like, I mean, there are constant surprises and things being found. I walked through there are a bunch of underground tunnels at the studio, and we were walking through there. And by the way, the archives used to be just sort of haphazardly stored in these underground tunnels instead of in a dedicated archival facility. And the woman I was walking with, one of the archivists, I just said, "Do you think there's still stuff hidden away back here that no one knows about?" And she said, "Oh yeah, for sure." You know, she goes down there all the time and unlocks doors that haven't been unlocked in 50 years and finds stuff, finds magical stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of material.
So we actually also have a lot of questions about gameplay, so we can move on to that. What is Mickey's motivation within the story, and does it change at any point?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things I'm most proud of, to tell you the truth. You know, most video games, I mean, I called Deus Ex Deus Ex because it came from Deus Ex Machina, which is like, you know, God from the machine. It's like a classic, terrible storytelling technique. It's like the oh my gosh, the hero is about to be eaten by a dragon, but then magically the dam bursts and washes the dragon away. You know, that's a Deus Ex Machina. Most video games have terrible stories, you know? And so I always, you know, again, I make games with terrible stories too, but at least I try not to. And this one, you know, we're trying to make Mickey a hero, right? So he goes through a pretty amazing arc. I mean, he starts out trapped in this world where he doesn't belong. I mean, he's not forgotten. He's not rejected. And all he wants to do is escape and get back home. But, that's his initial, that's the player's initial goal. And then as he explores this world, he discovers that, hey, there are a lot of characters here, you know, old friends of his that even he's forgotten. And he's responsible for making their lives miserable. He inadvertently unleashed a monster on this world, a disaster. And so Mickey devastated this world where his old friends are living. And so the change in his goals in his arc is he needs to accept responsibility for having caused this problem, and he has to set it right. And then he discovers something that for me personally is even more important, that he has an older brother, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and his older brother resents him for stealing the life of fame and fortune and love that should have been his. And so he has to reunite with his brother and redeem his brother. And at the end of the day, Mickey's redemption, Mickey has to redeem himself, you know, by taking responsibility for the problems of this world that he caused, righting those wrongs, making the lives of the Wastelanders better, and then redeeming his brother. And only by doing all of those can he redeem himself and then, you know, earn the right to go home.
So how long would you estimate this epic game takes to go through?
Well, I don't have to estimate, really. I mean, it varies because it's not a game, it's not a linear game in the sense that every player is going to do all of the same things in the same way. So it will vary. And to give you an idea of how extreme the variance can be, there's one map that we've actually shown, and many of the people on this call may have played it. There's a map. It's we call it Ticket Booth, and it's right outside the Small World, our version of Small World. And if you just do the minimum necessary to solve the problem on that particular map, you can literally get through it in 5 minutes. But if you do all of the optional content and you search for all of the hidden stuff, you can spend an easy 45 minutes on that map. So it's going to vary, just to be clear. But I'll tell you that we've watched a lot of people play of all ages, 8-year-old girls up to 50-year-old guys, and everything in between. And my first playthrough took 26 hours. I'm kind of a completionist, and I really like to poke around and stuff. And I was trying to find all the problems. So most people who we're seeing on a first playthrough are taking about 15. And here's the thing to remember, though. Your play style really does matter. I say that a lot, and I really mean it. In order to see and do and collect everything in this game, we think you have to play through it at least 3 times. That's the best we've been able to do. And so, you know, obviously each play session is going to get shorter because you understand things better, you know things better, and you're just more skilled. But you have to play through it 3 times, playing differently each time to collect everything. Because, you know, if you play in one particular style, if you're solving everybody's problems and using a lot of paint and healing stuff and restoring stuff, that's going to open some doors for you, but it's also going to close others. You're not going to learn about some missions that you might learn about if you play it a different way. And so we think it's going to take 3 playthroughs to get through. But players are already starting to figure out how to solve problems in ways that we never anticipated. And like, they're getting, it's so hard to describe. I mean, there's one point in the game where we set up a choice where you must free a trapped gremlin or go get a treasure. You can't do both. Except, about 3-4 weeks ago, a player figured out how to free the gremlin and get the treasure, which everybody in the team would have told you was impossible. So it's a game where I think it's going to take 3 playthroughs to get everything, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least if somebody out there figured out how to do it in less.
So speaking of spending time with the game, most Disney park vacationers know that you could spend an entire day hunting for hidden Mickeys around the park. Does Disney Epic Mickey feature any hidden Mickeys?
Yes.
All right. To what extent... Let's hear. You've explained that the role of the story in a game is to have the player interact with it and make their own decisions, and you've emphasized that playstyle matters. Actually, I think... How significantly will players be able to lead the story of Disney Epic Mickey?
Well, I kind of gave a partial answer to that, so I'm not going to repeat myself,
yeah.
But let me be clear. Every player is going to save Wasteland, and every player is going to redeem Oswald and, you know, basically reunite with his brother. So in that sense, the story is linear, okay? There is a narrative arc that, I mean, if you know any of the games I've worked on, that's sort of my style, right? I mean, it's a linear story, but how you get to the choke points in that story, the important story moments, how you get to those moments is up to you. And this game is very much like that. So it's not like it's not a branching story particularly, but how you play through it changes what you know about the world, what optional quests you learn about, how characters in the world feel about you, what the world looks like as you go through it. There are lots and lots and lots of things that you control that will change dramatically as a result of your play style and how you interact with the game and with the world and the residents of Wasteland. But the story itself is linear.
So how many of the 2D scrolling segments inspired by Steamboat Willie and Claw Cleaners will be in the game?
I've been shying away from an actual number. But it's around 40, okay? And by the way, they are inspired not just by those two cartoons. They're inspired by lots and lots of cartoons. You know, there are a couple that we used two or three times, but there are lots of cartoons that we used as inspiration, not just Steamboat Willie and Clocklingers. Those are just the only ones we've shown. I mean, you want players to have to discover something and be surprised by stuff, so we're not talking about or showing everything, even now, a week or so before launch.
So does Disney Epic Mickey have set difficulty levels, or will it adapt to the player's ability?
No, there's no way to adjust difficulty level. My belief has always been, not just on this project, I mean, for, I can't believe I'm about to say this, for decades of making games, I've been saying that the idea of, you know, letting players decide how to solve problems and giving them tools to solve problems in their own way, I've always said that idea has built into it a kind of a difficulty adjustment. You know, if like in Deus Ex, if shooting stuff is too hard for you, try sneaking around it. You know, if sneaking is too hard, try talking to someone, and you know, half the time you can get what you need just by talking to someone. So offering players a variety of ways to do things that match their interests or their skill set or just what they think is fun, I think actually builds in a dynamic difficulty adjustment. I don't want to be disingenuous. I'm not assuming that's true. I've watched enough players of this game play to feel comfortable that it's true. You know, like I said earlier, we've watched little kids and teenagers and 20-somethings and 30-somethings and 40 and 50-somethings play this game. And I'm not just talking about three or four of them. I'm talking about lots of them. And they're finding their own fun. They're figuring out how they want to interact with the world, and they're all doing okay. The other thing is, we do have a couple of systems in place that can help you if you're stuck. So, for example, in the game you collect tickets, and you know it's the same way you know every platform game or adventure game has collectible jewels or collectible stars or whatever. We have tickets among other things that you can collect. And those tickets, you can hoard them for bragging rights. You can in many cases buy your way past a problem, a challenge. You know, if there's someone who's blocking your path, you can sometimes just say, "I'll give you 50 tickets if you'll get out of my way." And instead of having to fight that character, you can trade a resource to get past that character. You can also use the shops in our quest maps to buy quest items. If you just can't find the last piece of X, you know, that you need to continue making progress in the game, you can usually go into a shop and just buy it. So we have that in going for us. You can buy health upgrades and all that. So if you want to make yourself tougher and you're willing to spend your tickets on that, you can make yourself tougher, which might make the game easier. Also, there are these little things called guardians, the spirits of the wasteland that are attracted to you. Different guardians are attracted to you based on your play style. And if you raise your hand, I mean you have the remote in your hand. If you raise the remote and hold it up for a second, if you're raising your hand to ask a question in class or something, one of your guardians will go streak off and leave a little trail that will point you towards your next goal. So we have ways of helping players out along the way, but it's not like you can go say, "I want to play this on easy, and now I want to play it on expert." No.
So are any of the game stages synchronized to music in the tradition of the early Disney cartoons?
There's some synchronization to music, of course. Yeah, it wouldn't be a Disney cartoony game if we didn't do that. But the more interesting thing about the music to me is, it's dynamic in some interesting, unique ways. Lots of games. I mean, I worked on a Wing Commander game back in the late 80s, I guess, that actually changed what tune was playing based on whether you're in combat or exploring or not. And, you know, almost every game does that now, and we do it too. So we have, for every place you visit, there is a different set of themes, a different set of tunes, I guess, and we change those out based on whether you're in combat, exploring, in imminent peril, all that sort of stuff. We do the dynamic music adjustment. But in addition, we're tracking your play style, And so if you're a character who's just sort of erasing everything you see and going for the most efficient solution to the problems and not helping people along the way, we're actually changing the music in each zone based on that. So if you're being super helpful guy or super efficient guy, we change the music, you know, the dynamically changing music changes based on your playstyle in addition to the situation, which is kind of cool.
Since you're talking about music, can you just quickly touch upon the composer who did the score?
Oh, I'd love to. I love talking about Jim Dooley. Yeah, you know, I had in my head this idea that there's a Disney sound. And, you know, it's not like Sleeping Beauty from 1937 sounds like, you know, Enchanted from a couple of years ago or Lion King or something. But there's something. You can close your eyes and listen to a Disney soundtrack and know that it's a Disney soundtrack. And I'm not enough of a musician to know what that is, what it is that makes Disney movies sound like Disney, but there's something. And I auditioned about a dozen composers, some of them really, really good, and some of them really close to getting it. I said, give me the Small World tune, you know, it's a small world after all, that one. You know, I said, give me that, but turn it inside out. So it's sort of recognizable but different. And then I said, give me a Mickey Mouse theme that sounds, hear the air quotes again, Disney-ish. And I narrowed my choice down to two or three when a sample CD came across my desk, and I said, it's too late. I don't have time to do another test. I mean, and then I looked at it, and it was Jim Dooley, he's done a bunch of game work, but he's probably best known for Pushing Daisies, the TV series Pushing Daisies, which, I mean, my wife loved that show, and so I listened to it. I mean, I would sit on the couch, like, playing a game or something on my handheld or something, and while that show's on, and I would hear this music, and I loved it. I said, oh my gosh, I gotta try this guy out. I mean, he won an Emmy Award for Best Original Score for Pushing Daisies. And I gave him the test, and he sent it back, and he nailed it. I mean, and I swear, this is the best music I've ever had in a game. I mean, you don't have to agree, but I love the music. I listen to it for fun all of the time. It's spectacularly good.
So I know we're getting close to the end of this, so we'll try and lightning round some of this stuff. There's a number of questions about characters. So why was it so important to bring Oswald back, a character that relatively few had ever heard of outside of the Disney faithful?
Well, it was important for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is, you know, the Disney family, Diane Disney Miller and you know, Roy Disney, I mean, they were part of bringing that character back. They wanted to bring, long before I got involved with the project, they were saying we should get Oswald back. We should get, you know, Walt's first big star back in the family. And then just, you know, as an animation fan from all my life, you know, I've been watching those cartoons, the Oswald cartoons, the 13 out of the 26 Disney Oswalds that still exist. I've been watching those in scratchy, horrible prints for years. And he's a great character. He's an amazing cartoon character. And it just seems unfair that no one knows it. So, you know, family wanted him back. Disney went and got him back. And I really thought he deserved better. You know, it's weird. I end up talking about him like he's real. It's very strange. I just think the world deserves to be reintroduced to this little guy. I really do.
We know that the Phantom Blot is a nefarious figure within the game, but what other key villains within the Disney universe will Mickey face?
Well, understand, you know, the Phantom Blot in our game is not the real Phantom Blot. We really did reinvent that guy. There is a Phantom Blot in Disney's history. He's been a perennial Mickey foe in comic books since 1939. And we remade him pretty dramatically. But others, the Mad Doctor, I mean, when I was a kid, my favorite Mickey cartoon was the Mad Doctor from 1933. And here's a guy who is pretty nefarious. I mean, if you go back and watch that cartoon, it's pretty grisly. And he only appeared in that one cartoon, and then never again that I know of. And so he seemed like a perfect villain for a world like Wasteland.
And then, you know, there you'll run into a version of, well, we've already shown pictures. I mean, the clock tower is one of our villains, and from Small World, and there's a version of Hook who's pretty villainous, and you know, in a Mickey game, you've got to have the Petes, right? Pegleg Pete, you know, Big Bad Pete, and Nevy. Pete shows up in every Mickey cartoon, basically, and so he had to be there. He's kind of a running gag, actually. He's around every corner.
So, going on, we have a few console control questions. First off, does Disney Epic Mickey utilize Wii Motion Plus?
Well, to the extent that if you have one installed, it'll still work, but that's it, really.
Okay, and actually, I know that we're close to over here, so let's jump on just the last couple questions. What does the future hold for Disney Epic Mickey? And actually, I'm going to bundle that in with the following question. Are there plans for a sequel or perhaps a Donald Duck Goofy spinoff?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who've taken a comment that I make fairly frequently that, you know, that I always plan, I planned a trilogy. The reality is I always plan a trilogy. I mean, I don't want to go into any project unless I have the not the sense, but the knowledge, the sure belief that the game could support more games. The world is robust enough. The characters are rich enough. And so I did actually think through a three-story arc before I started working on this, but I always do that. I had a three-story arc for Deus Ex. I always have a three-story arc. And the second and third games, if they happen, and sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, if they happen, almost never look like what I originally planned. It's just my way of making sure that we're creating a world that's robust and rich enough that players are really going to want to live there for a while.
Excellent. So I know we're at our time right now, so I want to appreciate you taking the time to speak with our media and to all the media out there. Thanks for submitting your questions. I know there's a lot more questions submitted than we had time to field on this call, but that's because we had so much great info to share with each.
Yeah, I'm a wordy bastard. That's what you're trying to say. Okay.
Excellent. But we do appreciate everybody's time here, and thanks again for your time, Warren.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Great questions.
All right.